outstanding wave ratio on the piece of feed line. Then you can do the typical open and short test. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, that's an excellent suggestion. So re-measure the standing wave ratio in the shack with a known good dummy load at the far end. If the cable is good, you're going to measure extremely close to 1-to-1 standing wave ratio in the shack. And if not, it's a double confirmation that something's wrong with the coax cable transmission line. But another thing Howie is suggesting is that when you made the measurement right at the antenna where it's radiated, depending on the kind of shielding that takes place in the MFJ, Viswire meter, antenna tuner, whatever it's called, I mean the antenna analyzer, the piece of instrumentation you put out at the antenna with certain orientations of that instrumentation, if the shielding is not perfect, it picks up some of the signal being radiated by the antenna and it confuses the readings on the inside of the instrument. In which case, making the measurement a few feet back from the antenna with a short jumper cable of known good quality might be the right way to go. If you suspect that shielding is a factor. But I like Howie's idea. Put a dummy load, re-measure the Viswire in the shack. Dummy load at the far end. I would again do that after a good visual inspection of the sensor itself. K2KUI, you got to know.
Also, sweep the cable frequency-wise.
It's very hard, though, for it to have good Viswire at one frequency and bad at another. Not impossible, but very hard. You got to know.
That's why it's amazing. Vertical. They give you the radial bolt cut. They give you the antenna with standoff. You know, a whole business. So all you have to really do is install it in their direction and hook it up, and it's supposed to work. Okay, very good. So I'd be listening. Otherwise, what I'm going to do, if he emails me anything further, I'm going to say to take the cable, put some kind of dummy load or whatever he can come up with, even some non-inductive resistance that he can file together, get close to half around 50 ohms, and see what happens, like Howie just suggested. Very good suggestion, Howie. Okay, now, let's see. I just did that one. Let me see, what else did I have here? Oh, okay. Here's another one that came. Last week, you guys were discussing meters. Yes, we were discussing. Rich had mentioned the meter. He wants to change the calibration on it. And that's for doing that. Okay. I operate mostly mobile instead because I cannot operate HF in any way from my living, from where I live, because of a fireproof building, windows don't open, you know, goes on the whole business why you can't do it. So I sit my mobile, and I like to operate GW from a mobile. The problem is I got to keep an eye on the battery voltage. So every so often I switch on, I have a little digital voltmeter, I switch on to see what the battery voltage, because that can go down to 10.5, and the radio will still operate properly, and I can still start the car. Very good. However, a friend of mine also has the same situation, but he's got a meter. He bought a meter some years ago called an expanded scale voltmeter, which reads from 10 volts at one end up to 14.5 volts at the other end. Where can I get such a meter, or can I make such a meter? Well, he's looking for made meters like that, an expanded scale voltmeter. Is there any modern way of doing it, or maybe my old method don't work to take over?
Okay, there's really two issues here. One is how do you buy or build an expanded range voltmeter? I guarantee there's some beautiful websites on that. And if we choose the right book, there's going to be books telling you how to do that. So how do you set up a circuit with a shaping diode network, which is the way it's usually done, to get an expanded voltage range, expanded voltmeter, or where to buy it? That's one thing. But there's another huge issue here. A lead-acid battery, I don't care if it's gel cell, I don't care if it's so-called deep cycle, which is the world's biggest misnomer. When you this article that was brought to my attention. I'm going to bring your attention right now. My good old buddy Dave. It's a battery article like you wouldn't believe. Stand by while I find that article. Anyhow, it's a one hell of a battery article. You read this, and it's going to tell you information about batteries. There it is. Interesting article. There's the one. I'm pretty sure this is the one I'm looking on right now. When I find it, there it is. Battery. Fantastic. All right. Well, my computer is acting funny tonight. Got the article. All right. You read what this guy's got to say about batteries. And here is an expert if ever I've seen one. www.eham.net/articles/1641. I'm going to give you all that slowly now. whiskey.eham. I'll spell that. Echo, Hotel, Alpha, Mike. eham.net/articles, which is plural, ARTICLES/16418. You read that article, and he's going to blow your mind when it comes to all of the phony advertising that goes on with so-called deep discharge bias batteries, so-called marine rated batteries, and whatever. The bottom line of all this that I got out of the article, among many other things, is that if you go to, I'm going to pick a number and I don't know the exact number, if you go to something like 11.5 volts or below on a lead acid battery, or by whatever means you find out where the so-called 50% point on discharge of a lead acid battery is, without a doubt you've only taken half the charge out of the battery he's capable of delivering. If you go beyond that point, you'll get power that particular time, and you think you're happy. Unfortunately, you're doing permanent damage to the place of that battery. It will never have the same number of ampere hours again. I don't care if it's a marine-rated battery, a deep-discharge battery, a high-calcium plate battery, whatever you call it, any of these lead-acid-type batteries. The good news is they're not expensive. They got a lot of energy for the size. The bad news is don't discharge them beyond 50%. You're doing permanent damage when you do that. Not only that, when you do deeply discharge it, like if by mistake you leave the lights on in your car in the parking lot all day long and you're doing an 8-hour shift, and you come back out at night and the lights are real dim, and maybe you're not going to be able to run the starter mode, you're going to do a jump start. Do whatever you've got to do. Go home and connect your charger or whatever. The amount of time that the battery spends in the discharge mode is continuing to do damage to that battery. You want to get it back up to full charge in a reasonably short period of time, but try to never go there in the first place, because you'll be down to a very small number of ampere hours after that. So, by some means, you've got to find out where the approximate 50% point is in the discharge of that battery. I don't know if you do it by voltage or keeping track of the current versus time, but do worry about that. Read this article I just mentioned to you. It's going to give you a lot of information. And thank you, Dave, for bringing that to my attention. And boy, am I forgetful tonight. I'm trying to remember. Yes. Why in the world did Dave put his call in on that? N2 something or other. My buddy Dave did put his call letters on that. And I'm forgetful tonight. Sorry about that. You got it, Jamel. KQKUI, KQRIW in the second half.
WB2HWW. Astron sells a meter, a panel meter that goes from 10 to 15 volts. Just add a series resistor.
Roger. Very good, Howie. KQKUI. Yeah, well, I've made a number of them. By just putting a Zener diode. I put a Zener diode. I put, the last one I made was fairly recent. I took a 15 milliamp meter and I put a Zener, 9.6 volt Zener diode in series with a regular 1N4007 rectifier diode in series with a resistor and a wire wound, four wire wound adjustable resistor only a few ohms. And I made the expanded scale voltmeter. That's what I have in the mobile. I have one in my mobile. Now, as far as the batteries go, Dick, I used for many years, in fact, I had them in the car, believe it or not, 10 years, two golf cart batteries. These were 6-volt batteries, 180 ampere hours. I had two of them in series. 701 amplifier, but that I had to stop the engine with the alternator put out the three phase because of the alternator phase. These are about three phase, so I had a three phase transformer on that. That's the same right. High voltage for the pair of 4X50B. Now, the golf cart battery, I had them for 10 years, and a number of times I literally really pulled them down. I could say, oh, it's around 10.5 volts, it began to become unstable. But I start that engine up and pumped that 100 amps that right over, so 100 amps pumped into the battery. And like I say, I got a lot of years out of it, no problem. Now, on a golf cart where they're meant to be, they're riding around with the golf cart all day long on the course. These batteries can get into a very discharged state, and they're not cheap to replace. They got quite a thing on the golf cart. I think they had four of them on the golf cart that I looked at.
Read that, you'll learn an awful lot. And there's a series of articles that follow this. That guy appears to be quite an expert on the subject. And how the go-karts get away with it, how the people with the handicap chairs get away with it, I'm not sure. Either they're not discharging them all the way, if the go-kart is really properly tight, when the person does an 18-hole course, I'd like to believe he has only discharged that battery halfway. Because if the go-kart goes dead, you've got to push it back to the clubhouse. Guarantee that golf is going to use pretty strong salty language. So I'm hoping they're sizing it such that it's only half discharged by the time it's brought back to the clubhouse. And maybe that's how they're getting away with it, and they discharge it second.
Let's say you got a golf cart out there that day and they're riding up and down the golf course with two or not, you know, four people on there, and each one weighs 1 pound. I can see the amount of current going on by that if one person has to take that cart out that day, quite a bit. I outlined actually what I did think is advanced scale. I put a 9.6-volt meter in series with a 1S without seven diodes in series with a variable resistor to calibrate. Use a DVM to calibrate this analog meter. And I have that, I can say, very successfully in Mobile because there's no good distance between going from 10 to 11 volts, 11 to 12, you know, you can actually watch it go down. And how far down, even if you only go down to 10.5, and that's where the radial factor stops and gives the problem. But he questioned me, he says, why did I pick a 15 milliamp meter? Why not a 0 to 1? And that's a good question. I found that, especially in the mobile, and I don't know how to explain this, but I told him, listen, and I'll try to, well, fix it. Put it in better words, I'm sure. The more shunting across the meter, in other words, the more milliamps the meter goes through, the more shunting is required, the more damping there is in the meter movement. In other words, the needle is more steady. Am I putting in the right words, Dick? Over.
You got it. The amount of resistance you've got to put across an extremely sensitive meter, a very sensitive meter, has got a whole lot of turn to that coil on the actual dust-style movement. And as such, when the needle itself moves, you're generating a lot more back EMF. Therefore, the load resistor you put across it is going to have a lot more of an effect. So the more sensitive meter requires a hell of a lot less shunt conductance or higher resistance, so to speak, and still do a good job of damping. And it's a lot of fun to take a sensitive meter and with the terminals on an open circuit and swing the needle back and forth by rotating it to the left and to the right with the face coming directly toward you. And watch the needle bounce back and forth between the pins. Then put a clip lead across the two terminals and repeat the experiment. On a really good meter, boy, you can only make it move a couple of percent when you swing it back and forth when it's shorted. That's a beautiful demonstration of dynamic damping. You can buy a science kit from Science First. Get a catalog from a company called Science First. And what they will sell you is a neodymium iron cobalt or whatever it is, one of these super, super magnets, tiny little super magnets. And you can drop the super magnet down an ordinary piece of copper tubing, small diameter copper tubing they supply. And you can take a similar size chunk of steel, drop it down the tubing, and it drops right through with normal gravity. Drop this magnetic thing down there, and it moves extremely slowly because of magnetic damping. Whenever you sweep a conductor into a magnetic field, you're generating voltage. Well, in the case of the tubing, the magnet is trying to go down the center of the tubing. The magnetic field is sweeping past the copper of the tubing, generating local voltage. The local voltage is across the circumference of the copper tubing, which generates current. The current creates a magnetic field, counter-magnetic field. The counter-magnetic field is trying to elevate the magnet you're trying to drop through. The bottom line is that the magnet drops through the copper tubing very slowly. Another example of beautiful dynamic breaking. KQKEY, KQRIW in the second.
Question, Zach.
Yep. Go ahead first, Paul.
Okay, this is WSUN. Okay, so if you had a magnet and a 20-foot length of copper pipe and another magnet and a 20-foot length of PVC and drop them at the exact same time, you're saying the magnet that drops through the PVC would hit the ground first?
By a long shot. And the effect gets stronger and stronger as the diameter differences get smaller and smaller. In other words, if you've got an extremely strong magnet that's close to the size of the inside diameter of the copper tubing, so that now the copper tubing is physically very close to the magnet, and you do that experiment, you may find that the magnet going down the PVC piece of tubing goes down there in 1 second. The magnet going down the piece of copper tubing takes 10 seconds to get there. Is that a difference in time, Paul?
Big difference. Big difference. Very good. Got to send this into the Mythbusters. That's very good. I like that one, too. That's a perfect example of what goes on in motors and generators and all with this back EM field. Very good thing.
Now, here's another example of that. For years and years, everybody had a conventional speedometer on the dashboard of their automobile. Nowadays, it's a digital display device or a bobber pole or whatever. But for years and years, what did that speedometer consist of? It consisted of an aluminum cup-shaped round object with a north-south bar magnet in the middle of it, spun by the speedometer cable. The speedometer cable is connected to the output shaft of the transmission of the car. The center conductor of the speedometer cable spins. It goes all the way up to the dashboard. It spins that magnet. The magnet spinning inside of that aluminum cup creates counter EMF in the aluminum, which creates a magnetic field, which fights the magnetic field of the spinning magnet, which creates a torque on that cup. The cup is essentially a Dawson Bell movement. It's got a hairspring to it and the pointer would move upscale, telling you how many miles an hour you're going, depending on how fast that speedometer cable was spinning. So there again, magnetic reluctance was creating the effect that we're talking about, the force, so to speak, the back EMF, the force, and a beautiful example of magnetic damping. Back to you, Mel. KQK. By the way, there was another person who wanted to make a comment. Who was that? Maybe not. You got it, Mel.
Okay, very good. Well, of course, so great. All right. Let's see. There's another antenna question here came in. You said something about the current effect. Oh, boy, let me see if I can get this reworded. tried jotting it down here and everything like that, like I say. Rather than print all the stuff out, you know, I have pages and pages, I sort of tried to write it out sometimes. I think I can't read my own hand, but I think I got it. The current, you said the current along like a dipole affects the field strength. Did you say something at the end, open end of the wire of the dipole, that the current is practically zero? Is that what you said? I didn't understand the difference. You want to elaborate on that? Over.
Sure do. And yes, I'm going to repeat that. Assume we now got a full half-wave dipole in free space. The center of that dipole with reasonable diameter of wire will have a resistive impedance of 72 ohms and no reactive because the dipole is the right length. Let's assume now that I've chosen 72 volts of RF energy to apply on that twin lead transmission line. So I'm putting 72 volts down a transmission line that is 72 ohms into a dipole that's presenting a resistive impedance of 72 ohms. So everything is matched with 72 volts on a 72 ohm system. The current is 1 ampere right at the junction between twin lead transmission line and the beginning of the center of that dipole. So 1 ampere is flowing. If I look at the sine wave of RF energy, which is going positive and negative, and I stop the action at the instant that it's positive, and we got a little bit of a discontinuity here between peak voltage and RMS. Let's keep it simple. Let's assume that I've got 72 volts of peak volts. At the instant I stop the action, I'm analyzing what's going on. I'm putting 72 volts across the dipole. That really means that there's 36 volts positive with reference to ground on the right-hand terminal at the center of the dipole, and there's 36 volts negative with respect to ground on the left-hand terminal at the beginning of the dipole, and 72 volts across the two. It's a fully balanced condition, and I told you voltage with reference to ground, but of course the dipole will be 72 volts. 1 ampere is flowing positively in the right-hand side, 1 ampere is flowing from the left-hand side negatively. If we use conventional modern-day current flow, assuming that current is the movement of positively charged particles, we get into a problem here with the traditional people. I'm one of them who in the very beginning learned that the electrons that flow, the negatively charged particles, and therefore the arrows the other direction. I won't go there right now. Just that when somebody puts an arrow on a page and says the current is flowing in that direction, to be double darn sure you're not getting it backwards, ask him in your mind, are you a modern person who assumes that current is the movement of positively charged particles? Then you and he are on the same page. Okay, so an ampere is flowing in the beginning of the dipole. A positive 36 volts with reference to ground pulse, I'm going to call it, not really a pulse, but I'm going to call it a pulse, is entering the right-hand side of that dipole. That pulse is going to flow down that dipole, come all the way to the far right-hand end, encounter an open circuit. The open circuit means that the voltage can't go anywhere, and it's going to reflect back. And it's going to reflect back that positive voltage. It's going to take a quarter wave in time to get out to the right-hand end, another quarter wave in time to bounce and come back to the left-hand end, to the center. So now this positive voltage comes back a half wavelength in time. And by then, the transmitter is putting up a negative polarity. So the positive voltage going out encounters a negative voltage when it comes back. It's almost a short circuit. That's part of the explanation for why 1 ampere flows there and why you think you see 72 ohms of resistance. But out at the far right-hand side, is a pure open circuit. You can't launch current into an open circuit. The current at the tip of the dipole is 0.0 amperes. Assuming there's no top half capacitor, it's a very simple, sharp point on the end of the dipole and it ends there. Now I'm making a couple of assumptions. If I now did an experiment by putting a loop of wire, a very small loop of wire at the end of a piece of coax cable as a magnetic field sniffer, knowing the fact that any current flowing in a wire, by Lenz's law, by Maxwell's equation, by Hertzian philosophy, by Guglielmo Marconi's philosophy, by Tesla's philosophy, by anybody's philosophy, when current flows in a wire, it must create a local magnetic field. So I got a small loop on the end of a piece of coax cable, and I placed it in various places near the wire of the dipole. By way of the local magnetic field being a certain strength into my instrumentation, which could be an oscilloscope, it could be a spectrum analyzer, or whatever you put on the far end of that sniffing piece of cable, I can measure magnetic field, which is telling me what the current is. I will find out the current is maximum in the center, zero at the tip, and decays in a way in between that follows a beautiful cosine wave. A cosine wave, or a sine wave at the standby now. Yes. 0 degrees, I said cosine wave, sine wave. If I start off at 0 degrees on a sine wave, and that's the origin of my XY plot, and I plot between 0 and 90 degrees, I will, let's plot 0 and 180 degrees. I plot 0 to 180 degrees. I will see the upper half of a sine wave. If I superimpose that upper half of a sine wave, stretch it out so it's the right length, and lay it on top of my piece of wire of my dipole. If I lay that graph on my wire, it will be telling me what is the local current on every piece of that wire. It is the upper half of a sine wave. The left-hand side is zero, the center is maximum, the right-hand side is zero, and in between, it is the upper half of a sine wave. That is the current versus position. Not easy to accept at first. And the theory behind that as to why the current decays from the center out to the end, and it doesn't do it in a linear manner, and it does it in a sine wave manner, that gets a little bit complicated. It's a bunch of boundary equations. A lot of people have solved it. A lot of people have made the measurement. Take my word for it. That is the answer. At one point or another, you're going to have to find a way of justifying in your mind why Mother Nature behaves that way, but she does. KTKUI, KTUI, WMXN.
Want to make your question?
Yes,
go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, my question is, I think it was maybe last week or 2 weeks ago, the name of the website where you could listen to the tech man on the website, like someone just recorded from it.
Okay, you came to the right place. If you want to hear past recordings of the TechNet, and except for tonight, essentially everything in the year 2007 is recording and you can play them back. It takes a little bit of practice to learn how to do the website, but it's all documented. So every couple of minutes, what was the subject of discussion, which reel it's on, which date it was, and so on. It's all nicely cataloged. I'll say it out first, amateurradio.tv. There is no .com, there is no .net, there is no .org. It's amateurradio.tv. That's the website, www.amateurradio. Two words linked together, no punctuation, double R between the two words, A-M-A-T-E-U-R. RADIO.TV. You go there, and you click on the section that says TechNet, and it's all there. Now back to you, Joe.
Roger, Roger. Okay, I wrote it down. I got it. Yeah, sometimes, you know, I go to my cousin's house, and they're kind of curious about the amateur radio hobby, so I would like to, you know, show them what it's about. And, yeah, thank you.
Good luck with that, Joe. You will hear a little bit of decrease in quality of the audio compared to what you're hearing right now. Even because the person is quite far into New Jersey and he's got a local repeater from Frenchtown giving him a little bit of interference, or because the whole system has to not have an infinite number of, a byte of data that he put onto that website, maybe it's slightly limited in the number of bits of the audio recording and playback. There's a tiny bit of distortion in the audio, which you won't hear on the real website, on the real LiveArc itself. But it's more than copyable for a good ham radio operator, and all the words are there. Everything Mel has said, and Dick has said, and all the mistakes we've made have been recorded forever, and you can go back and find them and have a grand old time. But thank you for the other comments, Joe.
See you soon, guys.
Okay, maybe Joe has no further comments. Eric, tell us what you think of all this.
I actually have a question for you. Okay, and it's an antenna question. We're talking about two different antennas, and, well, think of this. We want about 100 kilowatts CRP. One antenna is 17 dB a gain, and you drive it, you know, after calculating the loss of everything, with 4.7 kilowatts. And you have another antenna, 13 dB gain. I'm sorry, the 13 dB gain antenna you drive with 4.7 kilowatts. Right? Now, you have it sitting on top of a tower. It's sort of irrelevant that one of them's side mounted. They're slot antennas. And figure you have to put out a pattern which goes the distance of Long Island. What would you choose and why? Would you choose to have 1.5 kilowatts of 17 dB a gain, or would you choose to have 4.7 kilowatts of 13 dB a gain? Dick?
Yep. Darn interesting question, Eric. And if I was in the broadcast business like you are, I'd lose some sleep over this one. In one case, you're putting out less kilowatts. That gives you a slightly less expensive transmitter. It means you use less LIPA power, and you have a smaller electricity bill. That's the higher gain antenna. However, the higher gain antenna is getting its gain by having a much more narrow vertical beam width. It's got a pancake beam width, which is now more narrow, and you better be very careful in choosing the elevation of the peak of beam. You want it to fall directly on the horizon. And when it falls directly on the horizon, does that give you the best coverage on the day with super refraction, normal refraction, or sub-refraction? I'm going to explain those. You know what that is, but I'm going to explain it for the rest of the audience. On a day of normal refraction, the signal doesn't go out there by line of sight straight like you think it does. It goes out there and curves very slightly downward as it goes. It doesn't quite follow Earth curvature. It's called the four-thirds Earth rule, four-thirds Earth diameter rule. And the reason for that is on normal conditions, particularly at nighttime, you have slightly more moist, slightly more dense air down low, slightly more dry, slightly less dense air up high. The moisture-laden air, the water vapor, water itself has a diameter constant of 81, but water vapor is way below that, but still water vapor has a higher dielectric constant than dry air. So the air, the radio wave travels slightly more slowly through moist air than dry air. So it's traveling more slowly through the lower altitude air and a little bit more fast through the higher altitude air means the wave bends downward. And on average, it bends downward by the so-called four-thirds Earth radius rule. Go into any good radio propagation books and you'll find that out. The appropriate chapter of Antenna Engineering Handbook will tell you quite a bit. And I know of a book, I can't think of the name of the author right now, which really does deep into Rayleigh phase statistics, Ricean statistics, and whatever, of radio propagation. You can have a grand old time with that one. If you're a mathematician, boy, you can put a career into this one. Okay, what happens on the day when you get super refraction? In other words, the air is more moist, more dense down low, more dry up high. On some of those days, on super refraction, downward bending of the air, of the wave, directly follows Earth curvature. And if you're on the 10 gigahertz ham band, and your buddy is 500 miles away, on the lower tip of Cape Hatteras, and I talked to somebody there, 380 miles to be exact, and he's way beyond my Earth curvature. My line of sight from the top of my tower is 40 miles. And this guy was 380 miles from me, standing on the shore of the beach in Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, with a little bit of a dish and a couple of watts of power on 10G. He gave me a signal 40 or 50 dB above my noise up here in Huntington, Long Island. He sounded like he was in my backyard. Really potent signal. And the dish wasn't aimed at me. He was trying to break the distance record. He was aimed at a guy in Maine. And I'm off to the side lobe of his antenna. And I sat and listened to him calling and calling and calling. And I said, gee, you're so loud. Let's make a QSO and then go back to your calling sequence. And he did. And so his side lobe was 20 dB out of my noise. He easily heard me. He aimed the antenna at me and he almost blew my front end. That's simple refraction. And you can even get beyond that, where sometimes the air bends the waves even more than Earth curvature, and now it bounces on the ground and goes back in the air, and you can skip zones. And occasionally you get the opposite. Occasionally the dawn wave will have sub-refraction. That antenna beamwidth, vertical beamwidth-wise, doesn't sweep when you sweep it in frequency. And it sweeps much more slowly in this wire versus frequency. It may not be a super high-performance antenna, but it's got some other very attractive characteristics worth considering. Can you buy an antenna where all the slots are fed in parallel as opposed to being fed from one end, which also means you've got to tilt the beam versus the 6 megs of bandwidth? Maybe it's a very small tilt, but you've got a small amount of tilt if it's being fed from one end. I think it's a slotted waveguide-like structure fed from one end. So therefore, the higher frequency notes at the upper end of your 6 meg band are slightly higher in elevation than the lower frequency notes. Therefore, let me think about that. I think it means that either the far or the near viewers are going to be seeing a little bit of extra dispersion, group delay distortion characteristics on the higher gain antenna. Again, the lower gain antenna may be the more conservative, better approach. Back to you on that one, Eric.
K2RW, K2J. Well, broadcast antennas, and I'll tell you that a lot of thought has been put into these particular antennas that are dielectric. I was at Ogma. He's actually the guy who did all the antennas for RCA when Sidoff was doing a lot of experimenting in that stuff. But anyway, these antennas have, one antenna actually has 3/4 of a degree of downward beam tilt, and the other one has a degree and a quarter of downward beam tilt. And that's so that you can cover the folks that are close to you. Minimize the group delay distortion. Although, interestingly enough, these wide bandwidth slot antennas, the way they construct them is funny. They have these little things that they poke into the aperture to make sure that it's uniform in frequency across several bands. If you look at it on a VMA, across our 6 megahertz channel, the differences are in the 0.1s of dB. It's really quite uniform. The downward beam tilt, the way they do that is also interesting because that's just in the lower section of the antenna. These antennas are actually, you would think they're fed from the bottom. They're not. They're actually fed from the middle. And they're broken up as, instead of thinking of it as one antenna, think of it as 6 antennas all in parallel and all perfectly timed, you know, perfectly in phase with these segments of it.
Okay, that helps an awful lot on this group delay distortion or dispersion phenomenon. Angular dispersion, frequency swept. There's a whole series of very elaborate radar antennas, waveguide slot antennas that are frequency swept. As the radar sweeps up in frequency, the beam sweeps up in elevation. And so it becomes a kind of a height finder antenna. Where you see the target and what frequency tells you what angle of elevation it was from that radar. And so you've got a combination of range and elevation angle that tells you exactly where the guy is in altitude, as well as how far away from you he is, and how soon he's going to drop the bomb on you, if it was wartime. Okay, we've drifted a little bit far off subject. We better go back to your K2KUI. Who's our next victim? K2RIW in the deck now.
Okay, very good, Dick. This is Pete and Pete Y, very interesting, as always. And, well, want to take one more antenna question? You think you had enough for tonight?
Oh, we're on the roll. Go for it.
Hey, this is a follow-up to one I had answered by email somebody, and now he's questioning me why I said some things. Okay. I bought, some dipoles. And one is a 20-meter dipole, which he said I could hook my 50-ohm cable to, which I did, and it worked excellent. The other one is a 80-meter dipole, but because of the room I have, you said that the coils that I bought were marked, the coils were marked for quarter wavelength dipoles. You said that I should add a phallum to this dipole and not feed it directly, because you said that the resistance, that the feed point resistance will be somewhere around 26 ohms. Why is this happening? I don't know how to answer this. I'm a keyboard dick over.
WB2HWW, can I just pass some traffic?
Go ahead.
K2EJ, Eric, can you meet me over on my creek on my system?
One graph tells you what is the resistance component of a piece of an antenna versus length. And the next graph is on the next page, the reactive component of a piece of an antenna versus length. Bear in mind these are monopole antennas, which is half of a dipole. So everything you read off the chart, when you want to relate to a dipole, all resistance values or all reactive values, simply double them. And realize that it's a monopole, so 90 degrees of length, which is quarter wave, is resonant. And you can double check by seeing that all the reactance curves go through zero, all the reactants, at exactly 90 degrees. If you have any doubts, you'll see that right away. All right, and those curves, there's a whole bunch of curves on that page, for every possible diameter of the monopole / dipole antenna. But you can use very skinny wire or very fat wire, and then gauge on it. Those curves will tell you what is the resistance component versus length and the reactive component. So choose your diameter of wire, go to the right curve on the right page, and it'll tell you what the resistance component is. If you study those curves, you'll see something very interesting. If you mechanically make the antenna shorter, the resistance component gets lower. Even if you zigzag and added loading coils and top capacitors, whatever, no matter what you've done, establish resonance. An antenna tuner, top hat, zigzag, or loading coils, no matter what you've done to make the antenna mechanically smaller, the resistive component goes down. And how do you solve that reactive component? You can put a shunt inductor across the center if it's two capacitors. You can put a shunt capacitor if it's two inductors, and so on. There's ways you can put some kind of a tuning network in series or in parallel at the two terminals, the center of the dipole, and you can easily create, you can cancel the reactive component. We do it as a two-step process. You choose the right length that gives you the resistance component that makes you happy. Then choose the right shunt component to get rid of the reactant, and you're there. As simple or as complicated as that sounds, depending on your point of view, you'd be amazed how much money I have made doing that over and over again for various people, various ridiculous situations. Everybody thinks that to make the feed point of a dipole higher or lower, you have to go to these elaborate networks of folded dipoles, T-match, gamma-match, delta-match, or large and small diameter type, T-match type thing. People think they got to do all these elaborate things in order to make indeed match what they want. Somehow they completely miss the point that you just adjust the length accordingly, and you can make the resistive component anything you want, and then by one more step you get rid of the reactive component. If you go to the website of Dr. Tom Williams, W-A-1-M-D-J, is it? Or I think it's W-A-1-M-D-J. He go to his website, I think it's W-A-1-M. I think it's W-A-1-M-B-J.org. I'll find another website for you in a minute. You go to that website, you go to the bottom of the website, and you'll find the KQRIW information about doing perfect impedance matching of any dipole, even if that dipole is the driven element of a Yagi. So any dipole-like structure, you follow that 8-paragraph article written by me a year ago and put on Tom Williams' information website for microwave ham radio operators. These guys who are building Yagi antennas for Moonbound, they're trying to squeeze every tenth of a dB of performance out of everything. Because at 432 megacycles, the path to the moon and back has got 263 dB of loss. And you need a lot of antenna, a lot of transmit power, and a lot of low noise receiver front end, and high performance everywhere before WSJT came along. High performance everywhere before you're going to hear that echo of the moon. So people are fighting for every tenth of a dB. In order to do that, guys are trying to make the Yagi antennas and arrays of Yagi antennas be 50.00 ohms resistive, because that's where their carefully tuned low noise amplifier on laboratory test equipment was carefully adjusted. You carefully adjust your low noise amplifier to give you the lowest possible noise figure when it's connected to laboratory equipment that presents 50 ohms. And then you connect it to your antenna, which is 57 ohms resistive and 10 ohms reactive, and all of a sudden that beautiful tuning of your low noise amplifier is out the window. And most of the time, it gets bad fast. So you would think that you carefully impedance match your antenna to make sure the transmitter doesn't see good loss, to get high efficiency on transmission. Good common sense. Dead wrong. If you're a serious moon bouncer, you do a very careful tuning of that antenna to get it exactly the right impedance so that your low noise amplifier will do what it's supposed to do. Otherwise, it will not. So maybe that helps, Mel. KQKUI, KQLIW. I'll look for that website for you.
Hey, this is KQKUI, all right. Peter here. In fact, I have hopefully a very interesting JK crowd here. I have the 1950 edition of his book. I have it right in front of me here on page 67. So this was quite in detail. Very interesting. Got a lot of nice deep formulas in the book. That's 1950 edition of JK crowd. Most I can pick it up. It's fairly reasonable now. All right, that takes care of that, more or less. You're interested in one more?
Yeah, I found the website. Go to www.WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha. I had to call that wrong before. .org, yes. So www.WA1MikeBravoAlpha.org. You'll see this beautiful website on microwave ham radio by Dr. Tom Williams. At the bottom of his page, one step from the very bottom, is a article called Yagi Impedance Matching an Element Length for the Junior Boomer. Okay, you go to that article, and it will tell you how to tune your Yagi, your driven element of a Yagi, or any other kind of dipole. It can be a dipole in free space, or it can be a dipole in part of a more elaborate antenna. It will tell you how to get a perfect impedance match every time of your dipole. It's oriented toward microwave ham radio, so there's nothing stopping you from using that from on HF frequencies. So, Dr. Tom Williams, W1MBA.org, with www. In front of it. So go ahead with the next antenna question, Mel. You got it.
Patience, you have a patience. Do one more. All right, let's do this one now. Because the rule came in, you know, a lot of hams now have been able to get on the HF radio. And, you know, they said CW, you know, instead, but it seems like I'm getting a lot of people interested in trying to get on CW, especially ABC CW, which is for, say, activity during the night. In fact, there was a real nice group that got together that had the Northeast URP were on Saturday night with their contest, and I spoke by a CW, shouldn't say spoke to, but I did, and Town Nebraska and a number of them. On CW, the Northeast to our peers. But they all had very elaborate antennas. A lot of people are under the misconception that, you know, you have a QRP rig, you have to have some kind of QRP antenna. It's the other way around. If you want to have fun with QRP, you've got to have a very, very good antenna. I mean, these guys had elaborate rates, base verticals, and